Welcome, fellow Bereans, to the Bereans Bible Institute. I'm Pastor Tim Warner, and coming to you from my office in South Carolina. We're in module number 7 on the apostolic mission, and this will be lesson number 22, which will also be part 9 of this little subsection, dealing with the ministry of the Apostle Paul. All right, let's get our Bibles out and go to Acts chapter 15. We left off last time talking about the Jerusalem Council, talking about the letter that the Jerusalem Council wrote on behalf of Paul and Barnabas to the Gentile congregations in order to correct the problem, which actually came out of the Jerusalem church. You may remember that we talked about how that the Apostle Paul's ministry was being undermined by some of the Jewish believers who came around behind Paul and were insisting that the Gentiles could not be saved unless they kept all the laws of Moses, that is the kosher laws, the coming up to Jerusalem to observe the festivals 3 times a year, you know, observing the Sabbath, being circumcised, all those things that were contained in the law of Moses. These people were claiming that Gentile Christians needed to do those things or they could not be a true follower of Christ. And we saw that the reason that this letter was written by the Jerusalem Council was to publicly validate in writing the teaching and ministry of the Apostle Paul, whom Christ had sent as his ambassador or his emissary to the Gentiles. Now, we read the letter last week. We talked about the things contained in the letter, the fact that the things that were Gentiles were forbidden from participating in were idolatry, any form of idolatry, sexual immorality, and from eating foods or meats that was strangled or in any way the blood had been left in the meat so that they were eating blood. And we saw that all of those things are consistent with the way in which the patriarchs lived under the Abrahamic covenant. That is, from the time God gave the covenant to Abraham, that he was calling him and his descendants to be his covenant people, and that God promised Abraham the seed that was to come, who we learn is Christ, according to Galatians 3:16. That during that time, from that time until the law came with Moses 430 years later, that the patriarchs did not live according to the law of Moses, which didn't come. They hadn't come yet. They lived according to these other ways in which godly people who were part of his covenant people were to live. And so the Gentiles were told that they needed to live in that manner also. All right, so we dealt with that last time. Now, I want to deal with one thing that seems to be confusing. It's easy to say that, all right, well, the law of Moses, which came 430 years later, that was for Israel as a nation, as the collective nation of God, we saw also in Galatians chapter 3 that it was given, the law was given until the seed would come to whom the promise was made, which was Christ, according to Paul. So it's easy to see that, okay, the law came 430 years after Abraham was first given the promises, and when Christ finally came, when he arrived, the law is no longer binding on Christians anymore. So that's easy to see. But the problem is that the idea of circumcision. See, one of the things that was creating the problem for Paul was that not only were these Jews claiming that Christians needed to keep the law, but also that they needed to be circumcised. And we see that circumcision on the eighth day was part of the law of Moses, but it didn't start with the law of Moses. You see, circumcision was given to Abraham as a sign of the covenant that God gave to Abraham for 430 years before the law. Let's look at that, and then we'll deal with this question of why then, if Gentiles are to live according to the lifestyle of the patriarchs that were under the Abrahamic covenant, why then is circumcision not required of the Gentiles? All right. So anyway, let's go back to Genesis chapter 17 and look at the origin of circumcision. Genesis 17, we'll begin reading in verse 9. All right. After I get there. Let's go back actually to verse 7, because I want you to see how that the circumcision is linked directly to the Abrahamic covenant. Verse 7, he says, I will establish my covenant between me and you and your seed, descendants or seed, singular, after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your seed after you. This is God speaking to Abraham. Also, I give to you and your seed, and that is directly quoted by Paul in Galatians 3:16, the and your seed part. After you, the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants or seed, after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised. And you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised. Every male child in your generations, he who is born in your house, or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendant, he who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money shall be circumcised, and my covenant will be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised male child who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. Wow. Now, question. Why is it then, we can see here from this, the command that God gave to Abraham was that all of his descendants, all of his male descendants, had to be circumcised on the eighth day. And then he says, even a stranger, if you take a stranger into your household, if you take a Gentile and he becomes one of your servants and he is going to intermingle with the nation of Israel, if he is living among you, he must be circumcised. Right? That's what the text says. Now, this was 430 years before the law. Now, the law reaffirmed circumcision. So again, back to my original question. If we explain these other things in the letter that the Jerusalem Council wrote by saying this is the way in which the patriarchs lived prior to the law, why then was circumcision not included for the Gentiles? This is a difficult question, isn't it? Well, in order to answer this, you really need to understand the whole purpose of circumcision in the first place. Why did God command circumcision, right? It was a sign of the Abrahamic covenant. But when a Jewish boy, a male, was circumcised and he had the flesh removed from his sexual organ there, the tip of his sexual organ, he had that taken away, then whenever that child grew up and he got married and he then, you know, had relations with his wife and he had children and then his children were circumcised, and then they had children, and then they were circumcised, and they had children. You see that for generation after generation after generation after generation, only circumcised males were having relations with Jewish women. And the seed that God had promised to Abraham, because remember what Paul said in Galatians chapter 3? That when God made that promise to Abraham, he said to your seed, and then he says, which was Christ. And then in verse 19, Paul goes on to say that the law came until the seed would come to whom the promise was made, and that seed was Christ. And so what we have is, see, God commanded Abraham himself, before Abraham had a child, that is, before he had Isaac, I should say, when God told Abraham that he was going to give him a son through his wife Sarah, and that it would not be through Ishmael, God gave Abraham this sign of a covenant of circumcision, and Abraham himself had to be circumcised before he had relations with Sarah, his wife, who then bore him Isaac, his son. See, Abraham circumcised himself, and then he also circumcised Ishmael, but Ishmael had already been born while Abraham was uncircumcised. And so Isaac was born after Abraham had been circumcised, or Isaac was conceived, I should say, after Abraham had been circumcised, and then he had relations with Sarah, his wife. When Abraham had relations with Hagar, and Ishmael was born, Abraham was uncircumcised. But then God had Abraham circumcise himself, and then he had relations with Sarah, and then the promise of eventually the seed coming who would fulfill all these promises that God made to Abraham, that is, Jesus Christ. When that seed would come, it would come through a line where every single male that had relations with his wife, and the seed was passed from the male into the womb of the woman, where it then grew and was born, and then that one was circumcised, and then he impregnated his wife, and that same seed. You see, the Bible refers to the seed of Abraham as being even Abraham's, you know, descendants many generations later. The Bible refers to the seed of those people. In fact, it's in Hebrews chapter 7. We won't go there because we don't have time. But when Paul was talking about Melchizedek, that who met Abraham, he says that the Levites, the priests of the tribe of Levi, which were the descendants of Levi, Abraham's grandson, who was the descendant, I'm sorry, great-grandson, who was the descendant of Jacob, Abraham's grandson, who was a descendant of Isaac, Jacob's son, who was a descendant of Abraham. So we see that from generation to generation to generation, the seed of Abraham is being passed through the male and impregnating the woman. And then another male being born, having the seed in him. And so Paul says in Hebrews chapter 7 that the Levites, the tribe of Levi, who were the chosen priests of God, that they were in Abraham's loins as seed when Abraham met Melchizedek, and Melchizedek blessed him. So this concept, and it's not the only time it appears in the Bible, it's also included in the chronological information, that if you don't understand this, you'll miss some very important details about chronology in the Bible. That is, Abraham's seed or descendants were sojourning in the land with Abraham from the moment God gave him the promise. Even though they were in his loins, they were sojourning in the land. So anyway, this concept of the seed, which would ultimately be Christ, was being passed from Abraham, from the moment God made the covenant with Abraham And he said, I'm going to give you this son through Sarah, and then you're going to, you know, he's going to become a great nation, and, you know, the Messiah is all included in that. That before Abraham could impregnate Sarah and God begin to fulfill the covenant by Sarah conceiving, Abraham had to be circumcised because it was a sign. And it was a sign that God was supernaturally going to fulfill the promises that he made to Abraham by bringing about that particular promised seed who Paul says was Christ. All right, you guys get that? So circumcision was given to Abraham, not through Moses, because it would be too late if circumcision was given through Moses, because then Isaac would have been conceived by an uncircumcised father, right? Jacob would have been conceived by an uncircumcised father, Isaac. The 12 patriarchs would have been conceived by an uncircumcised father, Jacob, you know, and so forth. God made sure that when he was going to supernaturally, see, circumcision is a sign of the supernatural fulfillment of God bringing about the seed that he promised to Abraham to fulfill everything, which was ultimately going to be God's son. He needed a pure vehicle. And this pure vehicle was the circumcised male sex organ that he used then to as the conduit through which he was going to bring about these promises. All right. Now, I know that sounds, we're all adults here, but, it sounds a little, you've got kids in the room, you know, they might not understand what we're talking about, which is probably good. But anyway, you guys get the picture. So what then would it imply if that was the purpose of circumcision? What then would it imply if after Christ was born that all Christians needed to be circumcised? What would that imply? It would imply that the promises that God made to Abraham are going to still be fulfilled in the future through human procreation. But see, they're not. Because when Paul says in Galatians chapter 3 that when we are baptized into Christ, we put on Christ and we become Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promises, it's not because the Messiah has not yet come. See, if circumcision was to continue, then it implies that the seed, the promised seed, still hasn't arrived yet because God is still, you know, working it out generation after generation after generation, and the promised seed hasn't arrived. Circumcision was done away with to show that the Messiah has arrived. The promised seed is here, that singular seed that Paul says was Christ in Galatians 3:15 or 16. And therefore, there is no need for the male to be circumcised when he is going and having relations with his wife to pass along this seed, because he has already come. He is Jesus Christ, the Son of God. All right, does that make sense? So by bringing circumcision to an end for the Gentiles, it implies that the Gentiles are not part of that promise of passing on the promised seed of Abraham from one generation to the next until God fulfilled the promise. The promise is here already. All right, so if it continued, then it would imply that. All right, let's go to Colossians chapter 2. Now, this passage shows clearly, this is Paul's teaching, it shows clearly that something else was introduced to replace circumcision as the seal of the covenant that God made with Abraham after Christ came. See, the seal of circumcision was then changed to a different seal as a demonstration, not that the seed was still future, still had to come, but rather that the seed has come, Christ, and that we Gentiles or Jews are being clothed with Christ instead of waiting for another generation or generation for the promise to be fulfilled. We are now being clothed with Christ. So what is that seal now of the Abrahamic covenant? All right, here it is. Colossians chapter 3. Let's begin reading in verse 9. And he's talking about Christ. You can see that at the end of verse 8. He says, "For in him," that is in Christ, "dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily." And that's talking about how that Christ was filled with the holy breath of God in order to perform his miracles and do all this stuff. All right, and then he says, "And you are complete in him, who is the head of all principality and power." In him, that is Christ, "you were also circumcised with the uncircumcision made without hands." That is, it's supernatural. It's a supernatural circumcision. You see, I mentioned earlier that the difference between Isaac and Ishmael, even though both were Abraham's descendants, was that Ishmael was conceived while Abraham was uncircumcised. Isaac was conceived after Abraham was circumcised as the sign. And that showed that God was not going to fulfill his promises through human will, through human actions. God was going to fulfill his promises supernaturally. And that was the sign of circumcision, that the seed was coming through Sarah, through Isaac, supernaturally, because the conception of Isaac just something that was natural? No, because Sarah was barren. Sarah was past the age, right? It had ceased to be with Sarah according to the manner of women, it says in Genesis, right? And so Isaac's conception was a miracle birth. And that circumcision symbolized that God miraculously was going to bring about, by ordering the circumstances, God was going to bring about the Messiah by means of physical procreation from the seed of Abraham. All right, so he says here now, in him, verse 11, "you Gentiles were also circumcised with the circumcision made without hands," that is, it's a supernatural circumcision, "by," and notice what he says here, "by putting off of the body the sins of the flesh, by the circumcision of Christ, comma, buried with him in baptism, in which you also were raised with him," that is Christ, "through faith in the working," that is circumcision was a working, it was a physical act, but this is the working of God. It's a supernatural act. So he says, verse 12, "buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the working of God," the internal working of God. See, in contrast to circumcision made by hands. "Who raised him," that is Christ, "from the dead. And you, being dead," this is talking about our former condition, "being dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he," that is God, "has made alive together with him, having forgiven you all trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us." And here he's talking about the law of Moses. All right? "And he has taken it out of the way, nailing it to the cross." See, God took the law of Moses, which with all of its conditions, that in the law of Moses, unless as a Jew you kept all the law perfectly, unless you did that, you stood guilty before God, and unless the nation of Israel kept God's law, he said, you can't stay in my land, you have to leave. I'm going to drive you out of the land and drive you into your enemy's lands, and all that stuff that was conditional in the law of Moses. But by putting on Jesus Christ, we are clothing ourselves with the seed of Abraham, the one seed that the promise was made to, that is Christ. And this is exactly what Paul says in Galatians as well. But before we go there, I want you to notice this again, because this is very, very important. Paul clearly says that your baptism is circumcision, but it's a different kind of circumcision, because it's a circumcision of Christ, and it is being buried with him in baptism. Now, go back to Galatians chapter 3 for just a moment. Galatians 3, go down to verse 24. Paul says, "Therefore the law was our tutor," and he's talking about himself as a Jew. It was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under the tutor, that is, under the law. For you, and now he, instead of saying us, Jews, he says you, talking to Gentiles. For you are all sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ. Now, how do we become sons of God? Well, look what he says. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. That is, you have clothed yourself with Christ. For there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither male nor or slave nor free, there is neither male nor female. You are all one in Christ Jesus, and if you are Christ's, or you belong to him because you're clothed with Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. So see, look, you don't have to be circumcised in order to be Abraham's seed. Circumcision doesn't matter anymore, one way or the other. It makes no difference at all as far as God is concerned, because it was the vehicle through which God was going to fulfill his promise to Abraham about this particular seed. It was the vehicle for that. Once Christ has come, circumcision must be done away with in order that the new sign, the circumcision of the heart, which Paul calls it in Romans chapter 2, and he calls it here in Colossians, the circumcision of Christ, is a new kind of circumcision, which is being clothed with Christ. And, you know, if you go back to Romans chapter 6 and look at what baptism is, we are buried with him in baptism. We are, we put on Christ. All of these concepts are talked about in Romans chapter 6 with regard to our adoption, being adopted as sons and daughters of God, and therefore sons and daughters of Abraham, because we're joined to the seed of Abraham to whom the promises were made, that is, to Jesus Christ. All right, I hope you guys get that. It's a very critical point. It explains why circumcision had to cease with the coming of Christ. All right, now, let's go back to Acts chapter 15, and we're going to pick up the narrative after the letter that was written to the Gentiles by the Jerusalem Council. The council sent Paul and Barnabas back to Antioch, but they also had some people go with them. All right, look at verse 30 of Acts chapter 15. So when they were sent off, they came to Antioch, and when they had gathered the multitude together, they delivered the letter. When they had read it, they rejoiced over its encouragement. Now, Judas and Silas, themselves being prophets. Now, this is important that these two men, Judas and Silas, who accompanied Paul and Barnabas from Jerusalem back up to Antioch in Syria, that these two men were prophets, it says, right? That is, they had the gift of prophecy. One of the spiritual gifts, if you remember when we talked about spiritual gifts, one of the gifts, in fact, the most important gift, was that of an apostle, because the apostles had the ability to lay hands on people and transmit spiritual gifts, that is, to be the conduit through which the holy breath of God passed on spiritual gifts to people. So the apostles had that special gift. And in 1 Corinthians chapter the end of chapter 12, beginning of chapter 14, it talks about the these different gifts. And in the end of chapter 12, it prioritizes the spiritual gifts. And it has, Paul puts them in order. He says, first are apostles, then, or secondly, prophets. Then he goes on to list other gifts in order of priority. All right. So other than the apostles, which were the original 12, and there are no other apostles of Jesus Christ. All right. There was the original 12, period. When I say original 12, I don't mean Judas. Okay. Judas was dropped and Paul was replaced. But those 12 men then were the 12 apostles. But after that, or below that gift, that supreme gift, was the highest gift that any Christian could have at the time, apart from apostles, was prophets. All right? And prophets were people that God gave special revelation to, and they could actually speak on God's behalf as God's messenger as well. All right? So it says, verse 32, that Judas and Silas themselves were prophets. They exhorted and strengthened the brethren with many words. And after they had stayed there for a while, they were sent back with greetings from the brethren to the apostles. However, it seemed good to Silas to remain there. So when the Jerusalem council sent other witnesses to with Paul and Barnabas back to Antioch with the letter that the council had written, after they stayed there a while, all these witnesses went home again, back to Jerusalem, except for Silas, as far as we know. And Silas remained. And remember, Silas is a prophet, right? All right, so it says, Paul and Barnabas also remained in Antioch, teaching and preaching the word of the Lord with many others also. Then after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they are doing. Now, what are they doing? See, Paul here now, after they've gotten the verification, if you will, from the Jerusalem church, showing that what Paul and Barnabas had taught originally was exactly right. Now Paul wants to go back and revisit the same churches. And remember, these are the same churches that Paul wrote the book of Galatians to prior to their trip to Jerusalem. All right? So Paul heard that, you know, problems were occurring in these churches that he and Barnabas had founded on their first missionary journey. So he wrote the book of Galatians to them. Now he's gone down to Jerusalem. They have written verification, whatever Paul taught was accurate and was true, and what was contained in the book of Galatians now had the full authority of all the apostles behind it. Now that he's got letter in hand, letter from the Jerusalem congregation, sealed and signed by the original apostles and by the elders, and including James. Now that he's got letter in hand, Paul says, hey, Barnabas, let's go back and visit the churches that we established already on our first missionary journey. Verse 37. Now Barnabas was determined to take with them John, called Mark. But Paul insisted that they should not take him with them, the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. Now, you may remember, we briefly mentioned this before, but when Paul and Barnabas set out on their very first missionary journey, when they went to this area where they established these churches in Galatia, John Mark was traveling with them. He wanted to go with them and be part of their ministry team. Now, John Mark was Peter's nephew, and he had accompanied them back from Antioch back to Antioch from Jerusalem the previous time when Paul and Barnabas were in Jerusalem to deliver a gift, if you recall. All right, so they brought John Mark back with them. And let's talk a little bit about Mark and who he was. Let's go back to Acts chapter 12. Let's pick it up at verse 12. This is the story of Peter being thrown in prison, and the church in Jerusalem gathered together at John Mark's mother's house, which was Peter's sister, gathered at her house in order to pray for Peter, who had been arrested. Remember, the Apostle James, who was the brother of John, had been beheaded by Herod. And then Peter was seized and thrown in prison, and they were afraid that Peter was going to be killed as well. And so the church got together at John Mark's mother's house, and they were praying for Peter. And then, of course, you know the story. Peter was, an angel came and let Peter out. Oh, took his shackles off and opened the gate and everything, and Peter just walked out, and he just wandered over to the house where they were praying, and they couldn't believe Peter was there. All right, so anyway, so verse 12. So when they had considered this, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. And as Peter knocked on the door of the gate, a girl named Rhoda came to answer. When she recognized Peter's voice because of her gladness, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter stood before the gate. And you guys know the story. We'll skip down to verse 25. It says, and Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem. This is after this incident. Paul and Barnabas were present at that prayer meeting, by the way. Paul and Barnabas returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their ministry, and they also took with them John, whose surname was Mark. So we see that John Mark, son of Mary, Peter's sister, now is accompanying Paul and Barnabas back to Antioch. All right, so after that, let's go over to back to Acts chapter 15. I'm sorry, Acts chapter 13. Sorry, Acts 13, verse 5. This is on their first missionary journey. Remember when they left Antioch the first to go on their first mission journey to the Gentiles. They went to Cyprus, the island of Cyprus, and then they went up to the mainland. And then it says in verse 5, this is while they were at Cyprus, on the island of Cyprus. And while they arrived at Salmis, they preached the word of God in the synagogue of the Jews. They also had John, that's John Mark, as their assistant. Now go over to verse 13. Now when Paul and his party set sail from Paphos, this is on the island of Cyprus, they came to Perga and Pamphylia, and John departed from them, returning to Jerusalem. Look, what happened with John? He set out to go on a missionary journey, and they go to the very first place, Cyprus, and then all of a sudden, he doesn't want to do this anymore, right? He wimped out on them. And who knows the reason? It's not told us here. But what we do know is that Paul was very upset about what John Mark did. The fact that he set out on the mission trip and then he just quit and he went home to mommy. Paul was pretty upset about that. And we'll see now, here we are much later in Acts chapter 15, and Paul and Barnabas are about to make their second missionary journey to the Gentiles to go back and revisit the churches that they had already established. And so what happens now? Let's continue reading here in verse 36. Then after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord, and see how they are doing." And this is because Paul wanted to see what effect his letter that he wrote to these churches, the book of Galatians, was having on correcting the problem, and also to show up with this letter in hand from the Jerusalem Council, affirming pretty much everything that Paul said in Galatians, right? But in not in so many words. All right, verse 37. Now Barnabas was determined to take with them John called Mark. Barnabas is a nice guy. He really was. Barnabas had a big heart. But Paul was a practical guy. And Paul was like, you know what? This guy already failed us once, not twice. Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice. Oh, excuse me. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. All right. This was Paul's attitude. So he says, verse 38, but Paul insisted that they should not take him with them. The one who had departed from them in Pamphylia had not gone with them to the work. Then the contention became so sharp, that's between Paul and Barnabas, that they parted from one another. And so Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus. See, Barnabas is going back the same way that they went the first time, sailing to Cyprus, all right, going by sea. But Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of God. Now, you know, well, let me finish reading verse 41. And he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. So I don't know if you can look at a map in the back of your Bible, maybe you can see the missionary journeys of Paul, that on his first missionary trip, he left Antioch in Syria, and he went around to the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea, and then went north up to the mainland, and then worked his way back towards Antioch, going back west, I'm sorry, east, toward Antioch. And then when they got to Lystra, they then reversed course, and they went back around again and went back by sea back up to Antioch. What's happening now is on the second missionary journey, Paul and Barnabas have split up. And Barnabas takes John Mark, and Paul takes Silas. Barnabas and John Mark go back the same route that they took originally. Paul and Silas instead take a completely different route. They go by land. They go back covering the area from Antioch in Syria, going west now by land through the mainland up to the cities of Lystra and Derbe and Iconium and Antioch in Pisidia. Those are the churches that they established on their first mission journey. So Paul and Silas go the opposite direction. They're going to the same place, the same places. They're going back to see how those churches are doing that they had established and where these problems had come up. But they're going in the reverse. They're going in the opposite direction from each other. This shows how serious the contention was between Paul and Barnabas over John Mark. You know, a lot of God's people, you know, we think that, you know, the apostles were perfect, that they, you know, everything they did was, you know, exactly what God wanted and all that. But what we see is, you know, these guys were not perfect men. They had, each one of them had their own personalities. Each one of them had their own way of doing things. God chose different men. He chose Paul largely because he was hard-headed. Isn't that right? I mean, if you get somebody that's wishy-washy or somebody that's really sympathetic, they may not have the mission goals as their priority because they're too worried about, you know, hurting this guy's feelings or hurting that person's feelings. And there's nothing wrong with that. Barnabas was, in fact, his name, Barnabas, means a son of consolation, we're told in the book of Acts. And no doubt he was exactly what his name meant. He was a person who was very compassionate towards other people. And that's really a good trait, okay? But Paul was a get-her-done kind of guy. And when he was on a mission, he was on a mission from God. And he wasn't going to allow some namby-pamby guy like Mark to hold them up and to derail their mission plans because he couldn't cut it. You can see the different personalities. Look, both men, Paul and Barnabas, both men were men of God. Both of them were. Both of them were honorable men of God. It's just that they had a different way of doing things. You know, God uses everybody that, you know, regardless of your personality, God can use you in different ways. And you know what's remarkable about this is that later in Paul's ministry, when he was in prison, he was about to be executed. This is decades later. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 11, just before he was about to be executed, Paul says, he wrote to Timothy, and he said, I need you to come quickly. And the reason he was doing that is he was trying to compile some of his epistles and his letters to make, and along with Peter, to put together the New Testament as a authorized collection of inspired books, and to have the seal of the apostles Peter and Paul on that collection of books. And so he wrote to Timothy, I need you to come quickly to me here in Rome, and Luke is here with me. And why was Luke with Paul? Because Luke was the author of the Gospel of Luke, and Luke had been Paul's traveling companion previously. He wrote the book of Luke in order to leave behind in the churches that Paul established, to leave behind a copy of an authentic document outlining the life of Christ. And so Luke did that. He composed the Gospel of Luke. Well, John Mark, this wimpy guy who quit on Paul and Barnabas early on, ended up writing the Gospel of Mark. And Paul says in 2 Timothy chapter 4, when he's in prison and he's writing and he's telling, you know, Timothy, I need you to come. I need you to bring the documents and the case that I left in Troas, which was his manuscripts of these New Testament, the originals of these New Testament books. I want you to bring those with you. Bring them to me. I want you to bring Mark. I need you to pick up Mark and bring Mark, because he's useful to me for this work. So you see at the very end, even though Paul had kind of abandoned Mark in the sense of, yeah, he can go work with Barnabas, but I'm not having him with me. Even though he had abandoned him, later, Paul took a much softer approach towards Mark. Apparently, because what we learn is that Mark had, after this, had accompanied Peter, his uncle, when Peter went out preaching the gospel, because Peter went out preaching as well. It's not recorded the places that he went, but he did go out preaching the gospel, and Mark was his companion, just like Luke was Paul's companion. A little bit later in Acts, we'll see where Paul picked up Luke, and he picked up Timothy as well to be part of his team, along with Silas. So anyway, what we see is that Mark then served Peter, his uncle, very, very well later. And Mark then wrote down the Gospel of Mark based on Peter's preaching. You know, when Peter would go from place to place and preach the gospel, he would tell the stories of Christ, because he was an eyewitness from the very beginning of what Jesus said and did. And so he would tell the stories. And Mark put them in order, and he wrote them down in his Gospel of Mark. And so the Gospel of Mark has Peter's sanction there as well. All right. Now, I just want to read to you from Eusebius' church history. Eusebius was a early church historian. He wrote about 300 years after the apostles, and he wrote down a history of the early church up to his day. All right, so he includes a lot of the things in the book of Acts, but he goes on after the book of Acts, and he records a lot of what the earliest Christians did. He tells us how that who wrote the Gospels, who wrote the different books in the New Testament, you know, a lot of things that happened during that period of time. I just want to read to you from Eusebius, his history, book 2, chapter 15. This is what he says about Mark. He says, and thus, when the divine word had made its home among them, the power of Simon was quenched and immediately destroyed, together with the man himself. And he's talking there because he had been writing here earlier about Simon Magus. Remember, Simon was the guy in Acts chapter 8 who Philip encountered, the magician. Remember him? All right, well, he's in his previous history here, he was talking about that. And then he says after that, he says, and so greatly did the splendor of piety illuminate the minds of Peter's hearers, that they were not satisfied with hearing once only. This is when Peter was preaching the gospel. And were not content with the unwritten teaching of the divine gospel, but with all sorts of entreaties they besought Mark, a follower of Peter, and the one whose gospel is extant, that is the gospel of Mark that we have today, that he would leave them a written monument of the doctrine which had been orally communicated to them. Nor did they cease until they had prevailed with the man and had thus become the occasion of the written gospel which bears the name of Mark. And they say that Peter, when he had learned through a revelation of the Spirit of that which had been done, was pleased with the zeal of the men, and that the work obtained the sanction of his authority for the purpose of being used in the churches. That is, Peter authorized the book of Mark, his nephew, which had been written by his recounting Peter's stories. He authorized it to be used in the churches as an official gospel. Clement, in his eighth book of Hypostases, gives this account, and with him agrees the bishop of Hierapolis named Papias. And Peter makes mention of Mark in his first epistle, which they say he wrote in Rome itself, as is indicated by him when he calls the city by a figure or by metaphor, Babylon. Peter called the city of Rome Babylon, as he does in the following words, quote, the church that is in Babylon, elect together with you, saluteth you, and so does Marcus my son. So Peter, when Peter wrote that in 1 Peter, that's how 1 Peter ends, he wrote that while he was in Rome, and he referred to the city of the church in Rome as the church in Babylon, and he said that Mark was with him, Mark my son, which was his nephew, actually. All right, so we see that John Mark, even though he kind of got off to a lame start in his ministry work as a companion with the apostles, that he finished well. And in the end, he was, not only does he have a place in our Bible because he wrote the gospel of Mark for us, but Paul also made use of him when he was compiling these things, compiling our New Testament into an authorized set of books at the end of his life, just before he was executed in Rome. All right, so that's it for today. We'll pick up next time in chapter 16. We're going to look at Paul's second missionary journey now with Silas. He travels through Asia Minor quickly, and he makes great inroads into the West, as we'll see next time. All right. God bless you all, and we'll see you next time.